Please be seated. If you're a regular here at St. Thomas's, you know that I'm back after 3 weeks of vacation. How fortunate am I? I get to work in this truly exceptional community of faith, and I get paid time off to rest and recharge. Several people have asked me what I did on vacation. Besides puttering around the house, the major features of my time away were a week in Maine and a week of rehabbing furniture. Accompanying me throughout that time were my wife, Jackie, my daughter, Morgan, and the 19th century transcendentalist author, naturalist, philosopher, Henry David Thoreau. There are many adjectives one could put before Thoreau's name. The five I used are just common ones. He was in the news recently because his 200th birthday was July 12th. I dipped into several books during vacation, including Thoreau's Maine Woods. I also slowly consumed a wonderful new biography of his life. Sitting in our rented house by the sea, Jackie and Morgan did their own reading, in between my frequent interruptions with yet another Thoreau fact or story. One day, Morgan finally just got up and went into another room. I'll stop myself from sharing every little nugget with all of you. But I do want to say a little bit. Thoreau remains interesting and important, in part because of his then original understanding of the connectedness of all things, with results that remain relevant to this very day. He was the first person to study how development, spurred by the advent of the global economy, affected life both natural and human. He was himself a small businessman, his cobbled together living including partnering in the family pencil making business, including engineering several pencil improvements, and working as a well-regarded surveyor. Nonetheless, Thoreau's observations of the consequences of blind capitalism in his place and time fired his passion as both naturalist and abolitionist. It's actually quite simple to follow the dots from Henry in Concord, Massachusetts, to us today in New Haven, Connecticut. The two most important issues of our time and place, also related to unfettered capitalism, are environmental justice and racial justice. Most of you have heard me speak about these things from the pulpit before. I always struggle a little, fretting that I'm being more than a little hypocritical. Am I walking the walk as well as talking the talk? Today's gospel reading features Jesus talking and walking. Jesus prays atop a mountain. Jesus walks on water. The natural environment is essential to the story. Mountains reach up toward heaven. Only deities can master the elements. This tells us something about Jesus. But those are connections that are easy to make. We make them and then set them aside because in this story we are quickly distracted by Peter. As in the other gospel stories, the disciple I think of as Peter the impetuous talks first and thinks later. Here and elsewhere, he's often the poor fool who stands in for all the disciples. He says what they think. By extension, he also stands in for us. But this week it occurred to me to wonder, maybe Peter is actually a fool of a different sort. Maybe he is a fool in the sense of a medieval jester. As cosmic trickster, Peter just might be the clown master of satire, whose role it is to take the risks necessary to reveal the truth. Scholarly analysis of this story commonly focuses on the subject of doubt, and Jesus' jab at Peter for having that doubt. In one view, Peter's moment of doubt occurs outside the boat, when he realizes what he's done in that storm and becomes frightened. In another view, that moment of doubt is earlier, inside the boat, before he leaves out, when Peter asks Jesus to prove himself. Either way, Peter the impetuous unintentionally gets himself in trouble. What if instead, Peter the trickster knows exactly what he's doing? In that scenario, the story is about taking risks despite doubt, and maybe even because of doubt. It's about staring down the fear of probable failure, leaping out of the boat, taking that improbable walk, reaching out to the God who catches you and carries you, and getting ready to do it all over again. If someone managed to do this once, why would they ever do it a second time? I think it's because of the memory of those few miraculously dancing steps across those waves. One of the things that hinders my action toward racial and environmental justice is doubt. It's a type of doubt that surfaces when a problem is terrifyingly daunting in its massiveness and intractability. My tiny and weak self can't possibly make any difference. I might as well try to walk on water. I might as well try. In response to such fear and doubt, Peter the trickster would say, "So what?" Well, he'd probably say that in a way that was snarkier and funnier. But his point would be this. It's only by risking belief that you even get a chance to toddle a few watery steps, the miracle of which will provide the antidote to many stormy doubts and fears ahead. At this point, I should credit the poet Denise Levertov. She wrote a poem about Peter walking on water, and years ago that poem got me pondering Peter's memory of those steps. I'm not going to read it now, but it is, copies of it are sitting on the piano. She'll probably move them over here after the service. Henry David Thoreau knew a lot of failure in his life. He never was able to support himself with his writing. It's hard to imagine. It took him years to pay off the debt from his first book, which he self-published to practically zero sales. Walden had a great start with critics and buyers, but it too soon fizzled. He struggled with doubt, discouragement, and severe illness. He suffered grief, watching two of his three siblings and his father all die of that 19th century scourge, tuberculosis. Still, Thoreau kept on, watching, exploring, writing, and compiling a massive body of increasingly innovative work. He too died of TB at age 44. Now, despite failure and tragedy, Thoreau's amazing legacy continues. The more I read of him and about him, the more I appreciate him. He is regarded as the founder of environmentalism by many of the activists in that field today. Quite famously, his essay, Civil Disobedience, was an inspiration to both Mohandas Gandhi and Martin Luther King. Now, this is probably a good time to acknowledge that Thoreau was famously not a churchgoer, having resigned from the church of his youth as a young adult. Sounds familiar. But he was an early member of that group, spiritual but not religious. He left because he grumbled at many of the strictures of the church of his day. But many of his comments about religion were considered very scandalous at that time. But most of us would take what he said as a given, particularly the transcendentalist idea of finding God in nature. Spirituality infuses Thoreau's work in a way that we are perhaps more able to recognize and appreciate than were his church-going contemporaries. As churchgoers ourselves, it's important to note that American Christianity has a less than stellar history regarding the environment or race. Even if one goes looking directly to Scripture for guidance about either, one is bound to be disappointed. This made it easy in the 19th century to open the Bible and find plenty of support for questionable behavior. With the promise of manifest destiny, God blessed white America, providing people of color an environmental bounty and service to that end. Manifest destiny then, or American exceptionalism now. It's much the same skewed theology that our nation has yet fully confessed to and atoned for. Then and now, there is a different way to read and understand the Bible. There's a different way to think and act in response. And that's where we come in. Thoreau died in 1862, just before the Civil War started. We live at our own unique point in the path of history. Now is the time to act for environmentalism and against racism. You and I have the perfect opportunity to be trickster risk takers who block the old path and help create a new one. Be an evangelist, talking about Jesus with your words and your actions. The way of Jesus is always the way of love and compassion, and there is no shame in claiming that imperative. Now, here are some suggestions for doing that work. Notice the size of the storm, but don't fixate on it. Let that storm inspire and energize you, but don't let it make you feel hopeless and helpless. Focus on the water in front of you, and remember that you're never alone. Take a deep breath and jump. Take one step at a time. Eventually, you'll probably sink. When you do, reach out to God or to God's designee. Let them dump your soaked self back into that pathetically fragile boat. And let your successes and your failures restore you for the next week. Now, I'm taking a long breath here because that was actually the end of my sermon at about 11 o'clock yesterday morning. That was before I heard the news about Charlottesville. After I heard the news about Charlottesville, it seemed that something had to change. I thought about rewriting that, and instead I decided to amend it. So you're going to have to sit for a a couple of minutes. A lot's happened, so let's consider this a sermon P.S. The most important work Henry David Thoreau produced during his lifetime were his lectures and essays about slavery. Note, however, that he was the most visible, but not the only member of his family involved with abolition. His mother and two sisters, political players far ahead of their time, were leaders of the local abolitionist movement. They corresponded with and hosted national abolitionist leaders, including Frederick Douglass, Sojourner Truth, and Harriet Tubman. The family home served as a stop on the Underground Railroad. They took personal risks. The sinful outfall of the evil of slavery is still with us. And one doesn't have to be famous or powerful to do something about it. Now, because I should, I'm going to go ahead and say this. The racism on display since Friday night in Charlottesville is profane. There is no excuse for it, no justification in Christianity or any other system of moral or ethical thought. In this congregation, we know that. But knowing it and repeating it is not enough. White people need to step up now. It's time to go farther than multicultural awareness and appreciation. It's time to go farther even than acknowledging and understanding white privilege and intersectionality. Black people have been doing racial justice work since they were brought here by force. There has been amazing progress and absolutely stunning obstruction. It's clear that any significant move forward requires significant participation from white allies. As a lesbian woman, I can speak personally about the power of allies. Justice-seeking queer communities have needed and will continue to need straight allies for success. Now, for a long time, I've been saying to myself, when it comes to racism, you need to do more. And I haven't changed a thing. Until recently. Recently, I convinced myself that my inaction was completely unacceptable and began taking a few small steps. I hope you will too. I know that many of you are already doing this work. Please, please continue and continue to be an inspiration to the rest of us. Now, I can't dictate the agenda for this congregation, but I hope my dream becomes yours. And my dream is that this congregation as a whole leverages its unique combination of human and physical assets to become a racial justice leader in New Haven and in the Episcopal Church. We have the potential for partnership with the Day School, which last fall began intentional and ongoing anti-racism work. I admit it, I have no idea what any of this looks like or how it's going to work. I just know it's past time to get started. The storm is in full gale, and Jesus is calling us.